Welcome to the Full of Tracy Monier commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 7:27 p.m. and that is Pacific time. And today is September 15th. So, today being Friday, it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I think the main thing that I want to think about this week is some of the relationships that we commonly think about are not really working, and let's just think about why that is. So, for example, the dollar is going up, and normally when the dollar goes up, commodities go down, and that's because the majority of those commodities are denominated in dollars. So if the currency goes up, then you can buy fewer of them. But that's not happening right now. In fact, we have the oil price going up at the same time as the dollar is going up, and gold is quite firm around the $1,900 level, despite the fact that the US dollar has been rallying for the last 6 weeks. So that's interesting. Then I've often regarded Bitcoin as a liquidity barometer, and that's because the times when there has been a big swell of new money hitting the market, Bitcoin does particularly well, and the price has been advancing. And it is now up for the last few days in a row and back above the 26,000 level, bouncing from the lower side of the range. So that, I think, should be at least devote at least some time to thinking about what's happening in that market. But I don't think it's particularly liquidity driven right now. We're not seeing a big infusion of new liquidity. In fact, if anything, the volume of cash in the market is contracting, and China isn't particularly stepping on the gas in terms of printing new money. And Japan has basically unwound its yield curve control policy, and they've haven't formally ended it yet, but the 10-year yield is still rising. That would also imply that they're not being as forthcoming in terms of quantitative easing, but nonetheless, they are still devaluing the currency. But then you have the Federal Reserve still raising rates, the ECB raised rates this week, the size of the Fed and other balance sheets is contracting. In fact, the rising dollar is something that is an additional factor that constricts liquidity. When you put all that together, why would Bitcoin be rallying? So certainly that's something that we should think about, because it's not because of liquidity. There must be another reason. So I think that some of these interrelationships that we have are worth considering. Then I think the other big one is that money supply has been negative now for at least the last couple of months. But and normally, well, I think it actually, we can't say it's normal because it's never happened before, but one would normally think that if the volume of cash is going down, then that would have a constriction effect on liquidity. But of course, the other way of thinking about it is that it's coming from such an incredibly high level in the aftermath of all of that money that was printed during the pandemic, that even a modest contraction in the pace with which it's going up isn't really having a big effect on the total. So I think when we start to think through these problems, we should also then look at trends that are developing, and then attempt to plot a route through all of those trends in order to come out with an answer as to what's really happening out there in the world. So first, let's get on and think about the dollar. It has broken the sequence of lower rally highs. It has clearly bounced from the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and it is pulling away from the 200-day moving average. And I think the primary reason that the dollar is firm is simple enough, that the Federal Reserve has been more convincing than other central banks that it is willing to do what is necessary to get inflation under control. And since the ECB in particular said this week that they will raise, or they did raise rates this week, but that they are probably close or at the peak, and that they're going to wait and see that they believe they've done enough to get inflation under control. That is obviously holding out the prospect that the ECB is inviting stagflation, and the economy there is not doing particularly well. That's obviously something that's pressuring the euro lower, and obviously, if one currency is going down, the other goes up. And the euro is 57% of the dollar index. So then let's look at the Bloomberg dollar index, which includes the Chinese renminbi and then also the Indian rupee. And it has also broken the sequence of lower rally highs. This index did not break out as impressively and then subsequently pulled back more. It's already inside the range, but has bounced and on several occasions from the region of the 1,000-day and is clearly above the 200-day right now. And one of the bigger challenges is that the more history we look at for the dollar index, then at And sorry, I do apologize, not typing particularly effectively on my keyboard or my laptop keyboard. The dollar index has this long-term cyclicality, and it does have these 7-year bull and bear market trends. And because we've seen these trends, then it would be normal to think that we're right at the end of one of those big bullish trends, but the price is certainly going up at present, and it's quite likely that the dollar's preeminence is going to persist for as long as the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates. Now, it's pretty easy to make an argument for why the dollar should be going lower over the longer term, that there are massive unfunded liabilities, and the Social Security fund is going to run dry within the decade, and eventually that's going to require significant additional either money printing or taxation. And there is not one of the political parties is running on a fiscal austerity or a fiscal responsibility ticket, so there's no chance of it actually occurring, regardless of how much they want to bleat about their efforts to get inflation under control or spending responsibility under control. That's irrelevant as long as the dollar index is rising. There is also the clear potential that what is happening right now is that the Federal Reserve is acting in a fairly overt manner to try and create a market for US treasuries. And this is also, I think, a rather interesting development here, that we continue to see government bond yields rising, and the 10-year yield was up another 4 basis points today. It's right in the region of 4 1/3 now, but this is a new closing low for the week, or excuse me, a new closing high for the week, and it looks like it is popping on the upside here. So it's natural then to think that if bond yields are rising and still rising, that we should start to see some pressure on stocks because you have this very clear competition. The relative attraction of every market is assessed by every individual investor. And if you can get 4 1/3 for 10-year money, it means that you're getting a lot more than that for shorter dated money. So, let's say, for example, one is willing to annualize the yield for a 3-month and just roll it forward for 4 months. Well, then you're going to get about 5.5%. So, 5.5% for doing absolutely nothing with your money. So then let's just compare that to what you're getting in the stock market. Now, if you were invested in the Nasdaq, well, then the argument is you're definitely getting compensated. You're up 31% this year. If you were just invested in very conservative stocks in, for example, the Dow Jones, and you were relying on simple price appreciation, well, then you're not being compensated. You might have got a couple of dividends along the way, so you might have pretty much the same return from rolling over a 3 month yield as you would have from investing in the Dow Jones, and I don't think that's attractive enough. So as interest rates rise, then that is going to continue to put pressure on valuations. And it's just an increasingly high hurdle over which the valuation and the earnings have to jump in order to become attractive for investors. And given that we've seen a massive jump in interest rates, I think the vast majority of people are puzzled, or at least the people that thought that there was going to be a recession soon are puzzled as to why we haven't had a deeper stock market reaction in response to much higher bond yields and then this significant contraction in the or significant contraction in the supply of liquidity that's been available to investors. So obviously, then something else is propping up stocks. But I do think that we're now at this point. If when we think about the 10-year yield, the fact that the yield is now moving higher is beginning to have an effect on the stock market. The Nasdaq being down today in response to a move higher in the 10-year is obviously a clear development. The one thing that I was talking about in the broadcast yesterday was that today was triple witching, and that we had a very strong day right across asset classes yesterday. Almost every stock was higher, oil was higher, gold was higher, bonds were quiet, and stock markets internationally all rallied. And that has not been sustained in here today. So the expiry of all of the options for the third quarter, that allowed people to reassess, to think about what they're going to do with their money for the fourth quarter. And then we know for a fact that the repayments on student loans is going to start again in 2 weeks' time. We know that the money in people's pockets, and particularly in their bank accounts, that has been in there since the pandemic and all of the direct transfers to consumers is pretty much exhausted. So this is happening at the same time that people have to start making repayments on their student loans, and that is going to have a knock-on effect for consumer demand. So it's basically a massive transfer of money from the consumer to the government. Now, that is something, and of course, to pension funds as well that hold those SLB loans. So, what of course that also means is that the deficit in the government is going to improve at exactly the same time that the consumer has a difficult period of time. So, now let's just zoom in then and think about the Nasdaq. So the Nasdaq is pausing here below the 16,000 level, and it was, and I do think that we are due some, at least some consolidation. We've had a storming rally since the beginning of this year. It peaked right there in the middle of July. When I was thinking about surprises for 2023, back in January, the biggest surprise I was thinking about was that perhaps instead of seeing the market go down in the first half, and up in the second half, then perhaps we might see the market go up in the first half and down in the second half. Well, it definitely went up in the first half, and I am rather sorry I didn't put more money to work on chasing that rally. I think I just underestimated the speed with which the market would rebound with the mania that's evolving around artificial intelligence. In fact, I'm at in San Francisco right now, and I had a drink with the other delegates of the conference I'm attending tomorrow, the American Association of Professional Technical Analysts, and one of the people I was talking with is a data scientist. And I intend to pick his brain a bit more about the large language models tomorrow. The one thing I will say for certain is that when I went to write a bio for this conference, I used ChatGPT to do it. It did a much better job of it than I would do. And then I've also been looking at ChatGPT for just simple proofreading. And then, and be quite honest about it, I probably should take the time to do a better job of proofreading. But I am now currently spending over an hour a day formatting the website and cutting up audios and videos and posting on the two separate venues at present. So, that was the primary reason I started thinking about ChatGPT as a proofreading service. And I think that's something that's very interesting. I should perhaps have come to that conclusion earlier, but I do think that now that we are in the second half of the year, that we are more likely than not to see some weakness in markets coming through, and that is most especially the case if we see yields moving higher from here. But mo yields moving higher from here are more about a lack of demand, rather than the need for a massive jump in supply. Obviously, there will be more supply, and supply has been one of the major factors in yields moving higher over the last couple of months. But if we start to see less consumer demand because of more loans that have to be repaid, then that will help to improve the fiscal condition. And of course, oil prices moving higher as well are also something that will help the fiscal condition to one extent or another, most particularly in terms of gasoline taxes, if nothing else. So there is certainly the potential here that we're going to see the Nasdaq rolling over, at least coming down to the region of the 200-day moving average. I think that is the base case here. But we may see it come lower. Now, of course, this is the big picture audio and video. So let's think about what this means in terms of the longer term. Valuations are high, and interest rates are rising, and liquidity conditions are tightening. And we're likely to see valuations contract first, and then subsequently, interest rates starting to come back down and support the market. So I think we are. That stocks are expensive right now, that prices will moderate. And then subsequently, that will create an attractive buying opportunity for later. But probably not quite yet. Then let's also think about what's happening in terms of the supply and demand in the market. Because one thing that we know for certain is that oil prices might be rallying, but Saudi Arabia is not using the dollars, the incoming dollars, to buy US treasuries. So that dollars have, or that oil for dollars, petrodollar system is breaking down because Saudi Arabia is no longer recycling their dollars into bonds. But Japan and China aren't buying the treasury bonds either, so you certainly have less demand. And I think that it is inevitable that we're going to see yields rise sufficiently to encourage new demand. And that new demand is probably going to come from consumers. And we'll see more of a savings culture starting to come through if savers thought that they might actually get a return. And that's also going to be beneficial for pension funds, that a lot more of the pension model of investing works when you have a real interest rate. So that means that they'll be able to increase their weightings in bonds. But obviously, what drove the massive bull market in bonds, which was the disinflationary trend over decades, is over. And now we're definitely seeing that the total return on the 10-year has changed. So if we look at that chart, I think it is still one of the most important in the world. And everything was working absolutely fine as long as this trend was up. And now the total return is down. So this looks like a clear break of trend, And it is now below the 1,000-day moving average. It is encountering resistance in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So the potential here is that what we are seeing is a secular change in the trend. And that would suggest that measures will have to be put in place to create sources of new demand. And that implies higher interest rates. It implies at some stage in the future that there will have to be fiscal discipline introduced. And some kind of renegotiation of the social contract around pensions, how they're paid for, how they're managed. And in this regard, Australia has probably got the best solution, which was to basically privatize the pension system. And creating superannuation has certainly helped to improve the pension outlook for the vast majority of the Australian citizenry. But that is something that is exceptionally difficult to impose when you have an established system already. And these kinds of big change don't generally happen until there is a clear crisis. And then, of course, when you think about the UK and the cradle to grave provision of free healthcare, then we're already seeing the crisis. And there are legions of people taking out private health insurance policies. So they're voting with their feet. And this is obviously going to have a knock-on effect in terms of both support for the fully subsidized system from the general citizenry, which they're already paying for private health insurance over the longer term. But generally, these types of change do not happen unless they absolutely have to. So, but I think this chart of the 10-year is the total return on the 10-year is far and away the most important chart in the world, and it suggests that we now have a competitive environment, that there will be competition for funds. When we had the 17 or 18 trillion of negative yielding debt, there was absolutely no pressure under which any government had to or had to weigh in. They could do whatever they wanted, and they could still sell as many bonds as they liked. Those days are over. And the volume of negative yielding debt has disappeared. And now we're seeing yields that are trending higher, and at least in the USA, and the total return that is trending lower. Now, when we think then about what's going to happen next, well, I think we're going to have a deflationary shock. What's interesting is that the 10-year in the UK is looking kind of toppy. Now, it was up about 7 basis points in here today, and so far this is just a consolidation. But if we see the 10-year yield starting to come back down, and this will be more of a reflection that the UK economy is struggling, that property prices are trending downwards, and that the uptick in mortgage payments for large numbers of consumers, that is going to siphon money out of the economy, and that will help to bring some of the inflationary problems under control. But then, of course, we have this looming issue with the oil price, and Brent crude has a startlingly similar pattern to the dollar index. And the Brent crude price is up to nearly $94 now. It has clearly broken the sequence of lower rally highs, and it is trending higher. So this is not about suddenly a lack of available supply. This is an intentional act. And this is being driven by the willingness of OPEC and Russia to produce less, and in order to support prices. And It's not like the rest of the world has run out of oil. It's simply that ex-OPEC supply is constrained, and it's simply a political decision to avoid producing some of that additional oil. US oil production is almost back at its all-time peak. So this is not simply that OPEC Plus is restricting supply, but that demand is still fairly robust. And even though the Chinese property sector has been under pressure, oil demand there has remained robust. So we're still in an environment where the global economy is expanding, even though liquidity conditions have tightened and economic growth is slowing down. The oil demand is still robust, and that's helping to support prices. Now, the next question is, when are we going to see a meaningful supply response? Well, US production is already rising. And then let's think about Suncor Energy in Canada. They are a higher cost producer, and bitumen is not exactly environmentally safe, or I guess environmentally friendly. But one thing we've seen on several occasions over the last 15 years is that every rally has failed. And we've seen the price get up to $45 on three separate occasions in the last decade, and the price has failed. So it is now rebounding. And I think that's in US dollar terms. If we look at this in domestic, or I guess local currency terms, the price is coming back into the region of the peaks as well. But there's an awfully long base formation below 50 Canadian dollars. And there is the potential that on this occasion it will pop back on the upside. Now, we had a spike peak up to 70 in 2008, but this is basically about as high as prices get. And that spike higher only lasted for about 6 months, whereas prices more or less have ranged around the $40 level since 2009. So if there isn't a big response from non-OPEC supply, well, then Alberta sands are likely to become more of a potential source. We're also likely to see a big uptick in offshore supply. Now, that is going to require some capital, and it's going to require more spending. The oil services sector is responding, and I do expect it to continue to trend higher, but it was in negative territory today. The biggest impediment to increasing supply, particularly in the USA, is the success of the anti-oil movement and the environmental lobby. There is something that's really at the back of my mind. When we think about all of the focus that we have on reducing carbon emissions, and these responses that have been proposed, are they not especially efficient? When we talk about the provision of electricity, it's simply not possible to replace base load with intermittent supply. So it still means that the vast majority of the electricity being produced to power an electric vehicle is being produced by burning some kind of fossil fuel, most likely gas in the USA. So, in order to get around that issue, I think there's a self-congratulatory way of thinking about it all. But the thing that's at the back of my head is whether a lot of this is really a reflection of post-industrial angst, or the guilt that people feel at success. When people look at their lives and how easy they have it, and they look at the state of living environments for the vast majority of the human population around the world, well, then it's natural that one might feel, why should I benefit when the rest of the world doesn't? And most people are unwilling to simply accept that it is the lucky happenstance of where one is born in regard to how well one's life turns out. And people tend to think about that in terms of how could that possibly be fair? Now, one thing that I would say the number one lesson I learned in doing a degree in philosophy was that there are some questions that are just not worth spending the time on. And that is probably the greatest it's the greatest discovery that Wittgenstein came up with. And there is a good reason why you don't generally read Wittgenstein until your last year in college, because if you were to read it in your first year, you wouldn't study anything else. And I do think that is there is a an emotional tendency to ask these types of questions to which there are no answer. So we are starting to see more interest coming into the uranium sector. And the GlobalX uranium ETF popped on the upside in here this week. Now, I think most of the reason for that is because the bill aimed at streamlining regulation for uranium has been passed through on a bipartisan basis. So it is looking increasingly more likely to go into law. And that will reduce the cost of producing new nuclear energy, at least in the USA. The other side of that, of course, is that uranium products, in other words, uranium fuel, is dependent on a globalized supply chain. And that supply chain runs straight through Russia. And while they have sanctioned Russian oil and gas and lots of other products, they have not sanctioned Rosatom. And there's a good reason for that, because the nuclear reactors around the world can't do without Russian fuel. So there is an active attempt underway to rebuild an ex-Russia supply chain, and that is likely to be globally significant. But there is a coup at present in Niger, which is one of the primary origination points for uranium globally. There is the potential, and I think this is where the optionality in uranium is, and I think it is worth simply having a position in the uranium sector for this optionality in the event that Russia has additional sanctions imposed upon it, and those sanctions eventually stretch to the uranium sector, then the uranium sector globally will explode on the upside. And we've seen several large mines close down over the last decade during the bear market. And those companies like Cameco and Kazatomprom are going to be a bit reticent to bring new supply into the market. So Cameco has accelerated, and it was off the highs in here today. Now, there's nothing in the way of a downward dynamic just yet. But it is very overextended, so we could easily see a process of mean reversion. But the bigger, I think, or the more important potential outcome here is that we start to see more Generation 4 reactors getting built and permissioned. And the liquid salt reactors are certainly in the planning stage. Now, you have NuScale Power, and that's the kind of reactor they anticipate building. And the share is still going down, and I think it is likely to continue going down because Fluor, which is the majority owner, is looking at exiting its position. So Fluor continues to march higher. It's an engineering company, and one of the main things they build are factories and industrial facilities. And with the trend of reshoring and offshore and friendshoring, nearshoring, then this is the kind of thing that is right in their wheelhouse. Now, you can definitely see that it trended downwards for a good long time. And that was when the company was experimenting with investing in the product, in the projects that it was building. And one of the big challenges with that is they ran out of patience and capital. And the profitability from their ventures just did not manifest itself. They have sold out of the big iron works they were building in Canada, and now they're looking at exiting their position in NuScale, and that is putting downward pressure on that share. But of course, there is also the additional problem that NuScale is not going to have a fully functional reactor until about 2028, and given their run rates, they're probably going to run out of money by this time next year, which means they're going to be coming back to the market to sell more shares. And that's pretty much an inevitability. So we're in a new market environment where interest rates are rising and where its early stage private equity is doing quite well. And if you're a company that's just starting off and you're looking for your first 10 million investment, then that kind of investment has not slowed down, and there's still plenty of the big private equity companies are making that money available. But when it comes to the upper end of the valuation, where you're going through round four or five of evaluation, then there is a lot less money available. And just this week, we saw that Arm Holdings has come back into the market. So the share price went up yesterday and then came down a bit in here today, but not down a lot. But the problem, of course, for Arm is that it's SoftBank really trying to take some money out of the market and using this phenomenal advance we've had in artificial intelligence to take some of that money out of the market. Now, we're also going to see Instacart coming to market next week, and they have taken a massive haircut from their peak value. That's not just about interest rates. It's also about the fact that during the pandemic, people were flush with cash and they thought nothing of paying to have everything delivered. And now that we are coming out the other end of the pandemic and or how flush people are feeling is not nearly as high now as it was then, well, then people aren't paying as much to have their groceries delivered. And there is, I think, the additional reality that going to the supermarket is, in many respects, somewhat cathartic. And you also get to put hands on the kind of fruit and veg that you're buying. And certainly, I think, well, definitely in our household, that's something that we definitely want to do, considering the kind of cooking that we do in our home. So, I don't think that Instacart is worth even what it is going to IPO at. And there is the potential that the whole delivery type of business model is only capable of sustaining one or two companies. And then, of course, we had Just Eat Takeaway was the big success story of the European tech scene, and it has collapsed in value. Now, it was in positive territory this week, although not today, and it is still trading below the 200-day moving average. So there are definitely going to be some companies that don't make it after the pandemic surge, but then there will be those that do survive and that they will come out the other end in a better position. But certainly, we are seeing that several are running into trouble. And then CS Disco had its CEO quit this week. So the share was down in excess of 10% on the day and pulling back now from the region of the 200-day moving average. So I think these are both a reflection of the need for perfect execution. And perfect execution is a direct result of higher interest rates. So then let's think about the quandary that Unity Software have got themselves into. They have been supplying the market-leading software suite for developing games, 2D and 3D games, for most of the last 5 or 6 years. And then their charging model was based on just ad revenue, that if you built your game on their engine, then you also had to take their ad serve software. And as ads were served, then the company would take a slice out of that. So over the last 2 weeks, they've introduced a new charging model, which is basically going to excise the small players out of its business, and it's going to concentrate on the more successful companies. And they're under enormous pressure. So they have an enterprise value of about $15 billion. In 2020, it was $40 billion. And they have cash of about $1.6 billion. But here's the issue, that they've been running losses, a couple of hundred million every year. So now the next question is, are they going to get to a profitable position? Revenue is expected to rise meaningfully in 2024 as a result of this transition. But they're still spending on operationals. But those operations are quite a long way from revenue. So it is a company that could be profitable. But of course, then it's going to be down to the valuation. And right now, the PE is at 56. Now, this is on the assumption that you see continued growth in online gaming. But lots of these gaming companies are not doing well. So let's look at some of those. So I do think that we are coming out the other end of the pandemic, and that companies that did especially well, relying on people staying at home, with not a lot to do and plenty of money in their pockets, those companies are struggling. But then if we think about what's happening in terms of commodity prices, well, oil is rising because of an intentional hit to production. And even though oil prices are rising, the Nifty index is breaking on the upside. It's now clearing the 20,000 level. This has been really quite a mild consolidation in the region of this big psychological level. And the Nifty is now clearly trending higher. Now, the Indian rupee is also in a rather weak position here. So it was at a new low in here today. And now let's look at the Nifty on a currency adjusted basis. So the Nifty index will have to be rising more than the rupee is falling in order to justify an investment, but that is happening. So India is in a rather favorable position. So they have they're in the middle of their credit cycle. So there's at least another few years to run in that. And that suggests that the property prices might be high now, but they're likely to go higher. And then you have the friendshoring. So Apple is building more of its products in China, in India, moving away from China. I think one of the biggest risks for the Apple share price is simply that if they're not producing as much in China then and spending money in China, then why should they receive any favorable conditions from China? And I think that's going to weigh on the share price. Whereas India does look like it's one of the biggest beneficiaries of the migration of foreign direct investment away from China and into other countries. And then let's also think about Mexico. So the Mexican peso has been the strongest currency in the world, or at least among the strongest currencies in the world this year. And it bounced from the region of the 200-day moving average this week. So the trend of outperformance is still intact. Now, India is a beneficiary of the friendshoring, but Mexico has now overtaken China as the biggest exporter into the USA. So the iShares MSCI Mexico ETF, which is US dollar denominated, is now steadying in the region of the 200-day moving average. In local currency terms, the Mexpol index, which is local currency denominated, has pulled back rather sharply and is also testing the region of the 200-day moving average. I think we are in for a little bit of pause and consolidation here because Mexico is suffering from the need or the demand from investors for perfect execution in the same way that companies are. They have decided that, or at least AMLO, having been really the darling of investors over the last several years by being very fiscally responsible, has decided that he's going to try and buy the election for his anointed successor. So Mexico is now running a somewhat larger deficit, and the stock market is being punished for that. Now, it's also worth considering that pretty much the same thing is happening in Poland. They're attempting to run a somewhat more aggressive fiscal policy, and the stock market has pulled back violently in response to that. Now, this is the opposite of what we've seen in response, for example, to the Trump tax cuts that Donald Trump took office. It took him about a year to negotiate, but then he had this big fiscal stimulus, and the stock market took off in 2017. The stock market rallied with not much more than a 2% decline at any point for the entire year. And that was in response to a fiscal stimulus. So certainly you're seeing some countries trying to do that and they're being knocked back. And in fact, that is also what happened to the UK a year ago when Liz Truss took power and then tried to enact a fiscal stimulus. She was very swiftly knocked back, not only in the stock market, but most particularly by the bond market. So investors are not really willing to give any benefit of the doubt to alternatives, and provided alternatives are willing to do what the market thinks is necessary, then they are being rewarded. Now, we definitely saw in here this in the last 2 weeks that Erdogan in Turkey has decided that now he thinks that higher interest rates actually do combat inflationary pressures, and the Turkey ETF has first step above the base characteristics. Now, it was in negative territory this week, and we might see a process of mean reversion. But as long as it is continuing to find support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, I think we can conclude that Turkey is now back in a demand-dominated environment. But then, where we've seen some of the biggest base formation completions is in Japan. And the Japanese market has been rallying in a very aggressive manner. Now, I'm still leaving this in US dollar denominated charts because it does help to highlight just how acute the weakness of the currency has been in terms of helping to inflate the asset price, in at least in local currency terms. But the Nikkei is bouncing from the region of both the 1,000-day and the 200-day moving averages in local, excuse me, in US dollar denominated terms. Now, let's just look at this in local currency terms, and we have this sequence of ranges, one above the other, and each lasts about 2.5 to 3 years, and it's clearly breaking on the upside, and it may not stop at the 35,000 level. And I think this is an example of how Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is applied to markets, that the more we know about the trend, the less likely it is that it's going to be strictly repeated. And the less we know about the trend, the more likely a trend is going to be developing. So I think these are something that we see in terms of the development of trends. And it's really about the transition from the acceptance stage to the mania phase. So back in 2010 through 14, I don't think anyone was really willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the potential that the Nikkei would be at a new all-time high within a decade. But that is potentially what we're looking at right now. And there is the potential that it will go higher from here. So there's obviously an acute need to hedge out the currency. So DXJ is trending higher and doing so in a really impressive manner right now. But if we start stringing some of these issues together, then we have higher oil prices. Now, who does higher oil prices discomfort the most? Well, it's consumers. India is obviously a major consumer of oil, and so is Japan, but so is China. And India doing well and Mexico doing well are reflections of the nearshoring pattern. And then, if we think about what's going on in China, well, the H-share index is still under pressure. And it isn't rallying just yet. Now, it's going to require a significant flood of new liquidity. So, that, of course, is something that brings us back to think about what's likely in terms of Bitcoin. But I do want to cover this particular point first. India, China, or excuse me, India, Japan, and Mexico doing well. That's representative of a fear of the deteriorating relationship between the USA and China. So intermediary countries are likely to be net beneficiaries of that. And most particularly as an effort to invest in those countries in order to create a greater sense of loyalty to an or to create allies, basically. Now, the Korean market is also rallying here from the region of both the 1,000-day and the 200-day moving averages. And as we're simply in just thinking about South Korea, Samsung Heavy has got one of the clearest trends of a base formation completion and first step above the base that I've seen. And they are now building more ships. So there's certainly a trend towards building more modern ships and a retooling within the shipping industry. And the Baltic Dry Index is beginning to steady. Now let's put that up. So the Baltic Dry Index, having collapsed in 21 and 22, looks like it is putting in some more convincing support in the region of 1,000 and is potentially now on the cusp of breaking that downtrend. And then let's think about the Dirty Tanker Index. So the price of oil tankers is still declining, even though oil prices have surged. There doesn't seem to be a lot of issue with getting a favorable price for some of that product, or moving that production around the world. And the bigger oil tanker companies have at least stopped rising, although they are still in a broad trending higher environment. So I think it's an interesting environment that we have here. But one thing that I thought was interesting and I thought worth sharing in here today is the fact that, let me see if I can find this chart. I was having quite a bit of difficulty, or my computer was not wasn't playing ball with me. Here we are. So this is an interesting chart. I saw an edited version of it earlier this week, but I thought this one was more interesting. So, we've seen, for example, that Mexico now exceeds China in terms of exports into the USA. But then let's also pay attention to the fact that Asia ex China is far and away the largest exporter of goods into the USA. So, Asia ex China, and we don't have Japan in any of those. Well, Japan has to be one of those. But then let's think about, well, what are the other countries that are in Asia? So the Indonesian market is steadying here from the region of the 200-day moving average. And Widodo is coming to the end of his term, and the process of improving standards of governance that he introduced is likely to survive his premiership. So that's a very impressive outcome. The fact in Mexico that you have two highly qualified women candidates with degrees in engineering and software engineering and entrepreneurship, that's a very impressive array of qualifications for a politician, and particularly for an emerging market. And it suggests that Mexico is going to be well placed to build the kind of infrastructure necessary to boost exports into the USA. And then Malaysia. It does not have the trend of improving governance, but the share. Or the, excuse me, the stock market index is steadying, and it's above the 200-day moving average now for the first time in a year, and at least firming from that level. Now, the Malaysian ringgit has been under a lot of pressure over the last several years, and it is still trending lower. So we're not yet at a favorable position in terms of the Malaysian market, but it is looking more attractive. And of course, then the other big exporter in Asia is Australia. And they don't call it the lucky market for nothing. With the issues in the property market and the rising cost of mortgages, then that's likely to weigh on the economy. But then the rising cost of energy is certainly a benefit. And even with China's efforts to try and curtail a crash in the property market, they are still spending on infrastructure and they are importing coal. And China's cons our production of carbon is basically double that of Europe and the USA. And all of this talk about China being an emerging market, and it always will be, is a clear act of attempting to skirt around the normal requirement for a middle-income country to no longer be considered emerging, and to instead having to abide by the same kind of rules as all other developed countries. And China is in no mood to do that. And then let's just go back then and think about what's happening in terms of Bitcoin. There is a 4-year cycle, and the halving cycle is likely to move front and center, probably from about June of next year. So the price right now is steadying from the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and this is more about the potential for a surge in demand than the limited supply argument that generally helps to drive the market higher. Several of the largest asset managers in the world are attempting to launch spot-priced ETFs. And when they do, or when they are eventually permissioned, and of course there is an if in there, it might not happen. Well, then they will have to start funding the acquisition of Bitcoin in order to supply investors with a product. And that's going to soak up all the available supply. So there is the potential then that the price could march higher in a very impressive manner. But that is completely dependent on those spot priced ETFs, in fact, being permissioned in the USA. Well, the only exchange that is large enough and capable enough to provide the liquidity necessary to allow execution on those ETFs, Coinbase. And the share is putting in a first step above the base and attempting to find support. And then, of course, there will be demand for new Bitcoin. So then Bitcoin miners should become more attractive. So Riot is now back in the region of its 200-day moving average and beginning to steady here as well. So the optionality right now on an ETF being permissioned is quite cheap, and there could be a decision as early as next month. Or if there isn't next month, they'll have to delay it by an additional month. But I think the primary reason the SEC is not permissioning it is on a know your customer basis. And know your customer is not that difficult with Bitcoin, particularly if you introduce it in terms of buying ETFs. So I don't believe that's going to be the kind of the kind of objection that's going to stand the test of time. And the head of the SEC continues to get a lot of flack. He was basically given the job because of his expertise in Bitcoin, and then he started offering his services as a consultant to the same kinds of companies that he was supposed to be regulating. So it is a messy situation. But let's then just think about the 4-year cycle, because the times when Bitcoin does best is usually after the halving, which is when the reward for solving the equation to create a new Bitcoin halves. And it's going to halve in May, June of next year. So it's usually after that that the limited supply argument becomes a lot more forceful. And that's usually also coinciding with a period of time when there's going to be a surge of new supply of cash hitting the market. So that is quite possible that by the time we get out to the middle of 2024, well, maybe interest rates will start coming down then. And maybe the long and variable lag of monetary policy will also be catching up. And M2 is still within shooting distance of its all-time peak, despite the fact that it is falling on a year-over-year basis. But that's only the growth rate. The growth rate's negative, so the quantity is coming down ever so slightly. But we're still miles away from the trend line. And I think this is one of the interesting things that when we think about the continued uptrend in the dollar, it would be on the assumption that we do not get a massive infusion of liquidity in response to a bear market or to the threat of a recession. And I just don't believe that's credible. I think that the long-term cyclicality of the dollar is being delayed. And I think that's one of the primary issues that we have in the market right now, that because of the volume of cash that was created in 2020, a lot of the signals that one would normally associate with the market have been delayed. And I think that also helps to explain the fact that high yield spreads are still contracting. But we have to remember that this is a spread. So the 10-year yield is up to 4 1/3, and the spread is at 4.2, which means that the nominal yield on these high yield bonds is 8.5%. So when we had the massive contraction in interest rates in 2020, the spread went to 10%. The nominal yield on some of those high yield bonds was not much higher than it is. It wasn't much higher then as it is now, but that the spread was way wider than it is now. And a lot of companies were able to refinance during the pandemic. So we don't have an imminent issue in the high yield market. Where we have an issue is in governments. And it is governments are the epicenter of risk right now. And the outperformance of ex-US markets tells us that the biggest problems right now are in the USA and in China. And China most particularly, because it has more leverage and it doesn't have as many levers to pull in order to control that leverage. And it doesn't have the same dominance of global trade as it has had in the past. So I do think that China is the place that needs to be monitored most closely. And ex-US and ex-Chinese markets are the ones most likely to thrive in the long term. And Europe, even with its long-term dependence on the Chinese demand, the Euro stocks index is still right in the region of the upper side of a 23-year range. So there's obviously the potential that it will do better from here. And we've seen, I did a long review of banking indices earlier this week in Comment of the Day, and it gave us the same conclusion that there's clear outperformance in banks in ex-US and ex-Chinese markets, and those are likely to be the markets that do best over the longer term, but not until we see the US market rolling over. It's not just you need push, you all or pull, you also need push out of the best performing market. And the continued outperformance of the mega caps is still a very significant phenomenon. But when they do eventually roll over, then that is going to be, I think, a push factor in terms of pushing people out of this growth industry, high valuation growth market, and out into the rest of the world. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the week, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.